You see, you're telling me this is magnanimous importance. Mm-hmm. Now, what is all these 50 or 60 people calling us all up and, you know, this is nothing compared to what they are really should be worried about, what you are telling us. So I don't understand the significance.
What they're doing is more of a cover-up. Because if they really wanted to respond to you, it's real easy the way they can do it. I mean, it's just unbelievably simple. They start with a document. I'll even make it simpler. They follow the tech. They write up their overts and withholds. And they disseminate them. Disseminate them. That's what they do. They write up their OWs. And they disseminate them to the people who should own this organization, to the people who should be auditing the organization, to the real auditors, you people. They disclose the institutional crimes, the things that have been done, the outrages. And maybe, you know, look, the theory of auditing is that, you know, if you get it off in session and, you know, that energy release or ridge or whatever dissipates, then, you know, you go on. And there's new life, there's new beingness, there's new everything, right? Well, rather than dramatize their overts and withholds in the way that hides them, which PCs do in session all the time, which is what they're doing with you now when they call you up that way, which is what they're doing in the Wallersheim case the way they defend it, they don't. They just give it up. And they disseminate the fact they've done all these things. They shouldn't have done them. We've got a plan to try to correct them. Here's our plan. And, you know, per the basic first course that you get when you go in, communicate. But you don't communicate on a level to isolate individual by individual and cover it up. You don't do that.
But what is the question about you if we attend it, if it pays for it? I mean, they know it. Why keep on asking?
I would say that they're probably going to use the divide and conquer theory. They're going to try to isolate those that they think are going to cooperate with them and submit to what they want, and isolate those that are not going to submit and then follow the same policies they've always followed. For those that don't submit to them, they're going to figure out a strategy to attack, isolate, remove, separate from their position of power, use their buttons to destroy them, and they're going to follow the same old fascist techniques that they've always done. Mm-hmm. That's why your unity, your collecting together is your strength, because then you'll get a pool of money. You can hire lawyers to protect each other, to prevent the harassment, to help when someone has to go to a deposition like this lady here. The lawyers can be there to help you. And in that collective strength, you will equal their collective strength. Only your collective strength will be to unveil the overts and withholds.
They haven't thrown out pledges that have been signed yet, so they don't know who has signed a pledge and who's given money yet.
Really? Well, that's good.
We haven't secured, right?
We're very secure.
See, it's like the beginning, you know, like the beginning of the American Revolution. The people who started it tried to do it as in as closely knit a group as possible in order to prevent from being hanged in the first month. And once they got through that first month and there were a few more, then they couldn't hang everyone.
Mike, in the class action, could the church run up the time and the money by trying to do depositions on every single member of the class?
Okay, that's a real interesting question. My assessment of the litigation and the way it's gone is this. In individual lawsuits, the church has been variously successful, as I've said many times, they've been successful at all because of the nature of our legal system, in obstructing and delaying the orderly process of the lawsuit. And they have paid, I would estimate, between 10 and 30 million to do that. Whereas many of the cases, such as Levenda Van Schaik's suit settled for $150,000. In Massachusetts, there's no punitive damages. And there were none of the claims that are in a lot of the other claims where there are punitive damages, such as Christofferson, Wallersheim, Burden, etc. So her claims were in a different legal cubbyhole. They knew that from the beginning. All right? However, what they wanted to accomplish and what they were afraid of is that a litigation of that case would mean a loss to them on whatever level. And since the late litigation achieved a profile in the public eye, in your eyes, people knew about it, they wouldn't settle it. So they paid these millions of dollars, you know, under all these false premises. The case came down, the trial was about to start. The day before the case was going to start, they offered that money, and Lavender and her father decided to take it. She probably would have won substantially more. She probably would have won $600,000 to $800,000, although there were problems with Lavender's case because of Lavender. I mean, they had a lot of information on Lavender, and her background was somewhat rocky, as everyone knew, and as I knew when I took it. But the reason I took it, as I've said many times, is because no matter how rocky her background was, it was wrong for them to take that information and to try to basically blackmail her with it. And that was the basis for the lawsuit. But in any event, so they were able to hire these armies of lawyers over these years and stall many of these cases. They're now all coming up for trial just because of the, you know, the process of the legal system. It, you know, it grinds slowly but exceedingly fine. The class action suit represents a cycle, in my judgment, that is the next cycle above all these individual lawsuits. So in the isolated cases, because of the dearth of lawyers who are willing to get involved, who could push the case faster, because of the millions of dollars they paid to obstruct and delay, because of peculiar circumstances here and there. For example, in the Tonya Burden case, Judge Krentzman in 1982 got sick and had to retire from the bench, so we had no judge for about a year. And then Elizabeth Kovacovich came on the bench, and, you know, the pleadings were this high, and she couldn't even get into it. And that's one of the reasons that case. So they took advantage of, you know, these things that naturally occur. But the class, these cases are all now coming up. These criminal cases are going on. They've become more and more desperate, such as revealed by the check frame-up of me. I mean, it revealed their desperation to do something like that at this point. The class action suit will have the collective energy and hopefully money of a wide group of people. And what that means is more concentrated effort, more concentrated energy, and you'll be looking for relief. By that I mean you'll be pursuing claims that a lot of the other cases won't be pursuing, like return of your PC files, which is called an equitable claim. And oftentimes an equitable claim, such as in David Mayo's suit, the case proceeds a lot more rapidly, because there are fundamental rights that have to be taken care of and the courts have to move the case faster. So my read of this situation, if you get big enough and strong enough and push the thing hard enough, is that given the position the church is now in, it would be so catastrophic to the current management that the sheer weight of the six, you'd be riding on the 6 years of accumulated momentum, which would crest with this class action suit and sweep away in that crest, I think very easily, a lot of the opposition that we've traditionally seen comes from their lawyers. You'll probably see new management or partial new management, and they may come forward and say, hey, you're right, we will submit an audit. David Miscavige and Pat Broeker, et cetera, and they're all gone. Here's the problem. That may occur. I mean, in 1981, there was a big, Miscavige ousted Franks, Mary Sue, the GO, and became more ruthless. And now that, you know, Miscavige can no longer rely on the hidden data line. And he got through, he consolidated his power on the hidden data line. He convinced enough people around him that Ron said to unload Henning Helt, Ron said to unload Mary Sue, Ron said to unload Dee Dee Reisdorf, Ron said to unload Doreen Gillum. He convinced enough people to consolidate his power But now he no longer has that. And now the power is external to him. And I think it's pressing in on him. And I think there are going to be more defections. I think he's going to be unable to... He's going to become a Marcos. People are going to take over.
This question or statement doesn't have a great deal to do with the money or the power. It has to do with a real potential danger that I perceive to lives of young people in the church. And I base it on a conversation, several conversations that I've had. Among them is one from a guy named Willie Phelps from the AOLA, who in telling me about Ron's birthday party said this: "It's incredible what happened. It's totally, I mean, it's not like dying. I mean, my God, he totally at cause and at will. He's furthering his research. He dropped his body totally keyed out and to take off for the research because the power level of the body was just too small. It's a hindrance. He's more here than ever. It's incredible. You got to come and see that, hon," referring to the event that took place at the Palladium. He says, "You got to come in and get your confusion straightened out, because one of the things he's saying is that he doesn't want nobody, to have any at all upset over the fact that he dropped his body. That was one of the things he had read. It's incredible what occurred. He made it. He totally got it all figured out, and now it's the new OT level that one can do when they're ready to drop the body. They can do this OT level. Wait, what? You mean you have to drop your body to get it?" That was me.
R245.
You don't have to drink the Kool-Aid.
Well, that's my reaction exactly. I have some concern for the young people in the organization at the
sad.
Moment.
You just read to Michael Flynn's mind. It's real sad, frankly.
I would hate to have a ship full of dead children found at Creston.
Yeah, I think I've talked to enough people such as Keemer and Laurel who were around him in the late 79 period who knew his state of health. And the ideas that were suggested in what you just read are false.
They're not children. I mean, they're grown-ups. There are 40 and 50-year-olds that feel the same way, you know, that are either in the Sea Org or out in the field that sympathize with that.
Perpetuate that myth that he did that.
I just think it's dangerous.
To turn that into a question.
To be with Ron, Hannah
knows
that.
And the other data out to the public.
Of the conditions surrounding his death?
Yeah.
We're going to do everything we can. And they're going to fight that tooth and nail. We're going to do everything we can. I mean, it's
a shame.
Well, does anyone have any more questions?
Yeah.
I mean, Tonya Burton, in the innocence of Tonya Burton, I mean, she was just deposed for a week in Boston. I mean, this little kid is a gutsy little kid. And we walk into this room, and they got lawyers lined up, and it's Tonya and I. And they got all these lawyers lined up. And, I mean, when she got there, they broke the window. The day she was arriving, someone from my office was going to pick her up, and they broke the window of... the car that was going to pick her up was all smashed, and it was raining cats and dogs. So that, it was obvious, and it had never been done before. The hotel she stayed at that night, she received phone calls late at night. A trash can was thrown against her door. The typical stuff. It scared the kid a little bit. So we show up at the deposition, and I start the deposition. They were taking it, but I put on the record what I just told you and some other things that they did. So Harry Mannion works with Earl Cooley, jumps up and says, if you persist in this, I'm going to throw you out of here. And I said, well, Mr. Mannion, you have two choices. You're either going to do it yourself or you're going to call the police to do it. And I give you both options. And if you want to do the first, the option is open to you right now. Come ahead. And he just sat down and the deposition started. And they spent 5 days trying to, with all their lawyers, just tear apart this kid's mind and everything that occurred, and with every success story they could find and little contradictions here and there. And the upshot of the whole thing is one remarkable little story, I thought. I mean, she said some incredible things that I could tell you in the deposition. And they just roll out of her because they're true. But one of the things she said was they asked her, what were her feelings toward L. Ron Hubbard? And, you know, she said a number of things which were neutral, some favorable, some negative. And then they asked her some question about whether, what was represented to her and was he what was represented to her and that type of thing. And she said, I was only 13, 14 years old at the time, but he was supposed to be this supreme being and who could, you know, make everything happen that he wanted to make. And he had this big lump on his head. I mean, it's just a little kid, and it's really not that significant, but in a way, it psychologically is, you know. And the lump was getting bigger, and it was really like, you could see he was really bothered by it, and, you know, we used to dress him and undress him every day. And, you know, he'd go out, he'd try to cover it up. And I began to think, and it was kind of, you know, unsightly. And I began to think, if he can do all these things, why didn't he just make the bump go away? You know, and it's kind of a simple little thing, but in a way, it relates to precisely what this fellow was saying to you about at cause over his body and dropping his body and that type of thing. And this little mind, simply because she had the opposite opportunity to see the data, see the fact, see the man, compare what was told, see the everyday, the way things were run every day on the ship and the way things were supposed. She used to write up things that shouldn't be. And so she learned and had the privilege and the right, as all human minds have, to sort out for themselves, to think for themselves, think freely, and make their own decisions. Someone such as that kid and the people who will listen to him will not be making truthful decisions based on L. Ron Hubbard's death. That's why I said in the speech a couple weeks ago, I think, to my mind, one of the most important things for loads of reasons is that all of the true facts relating to L. Ron Hubbard's death be disclosed. My personal belief is that he was sick for a real long period of time. I mean, real sick. And, you know, he supposedly had a stroke the week before he died. The last will is just a line, through a line. I would like to know whether he was on a respirator. I would like to know what medications he had. I mean, there are people in this country, terminally ill patients that die every day because a doctor very easily and very simply, if there are any doctors in the room, they know that this is done all the time. They simply, with, say, lung cancer patients, decrease the respiratory volume, increase the morphine dose, which decreases the respiratory cycle, which slowly reduces the oxygen. This can be done over a period of days, weeks. Atrophies the brain, stroke, death. Cause, stroke. But it's done. It's done very simply, very specifically, very intentionally, and I'd like to know the answer to that. I want to know about this stroke. I know he had blood clots in his lungs. I know he took Coumadin on a regular basis. I know he suffered from a history of pulmonary emboli, so he had lung problems, which means that he was probably on a respirator near the end. And if he was on a respirator and they gave him, say, a central nervous system depressant of some type, and gradually decreased his respiratory cycle, yeah, boom, stroke like that. I'd like to know.
Mike, where is it on record that he had a stroke?
They told the coroner that. Dink told the coroner in San Luis Obispo that a week before his death he had had a stroke.
Is that on the death certificate?
Stroke is on the death certificate. Whether the week is, I'm not, but it's in the coroner's notes.
That's not what the video says.
Oh, no. No.
I haven't, the video's been sent to, or no, it, the audio has been sent to me of what was said. Oh, I'm sure it wasn't. I mean, I picture, you know, he's a regular human being, and I've tried a lot of medical cases, and I just picture an elderly man
going downhill for a lot of reasons over a period of time. I see intense pressure that he, I'm sure, was informed about. I mean, if he had become, if he had been indicted, he would have become a fugitive. The adverse PR consequences of being a fugitive are enormous. And he couldn't show up. I mean, if he showed up, everyone would see. Well, you know, it's like when Mary Sue Hubbard showed up in the Armstrong case, and you know, this is Mary Sue Hubbard who's up there bobbing, weaving, manipulating, you know, saying that processing is not auditing. I mean, you know, so the same truth, the same data would come out. It would be the true man, like all of us, a regular man.
Can Dink be depoted?
Yeah, we're going to try. We can find.
I have one legal question. What I don't understand is that every lawyer insists that these papers were stolen, the Notes material were stolen.
Right.
Why not making a difference between false pretenses and stolen? Stealing is probably much more stricter in law than false pretenses, because with false pretenses there are two responsibilities: the ones who gave it and the ones who dress themselves up under false pretenses. Now, stealing is one responsibility. You see, I don't understand why they don't correct it. It's either stolen or false pretenses.
Theor, I think if you're referring to the way Robin Scott took the the knot, supposedly, you mean whether he...
Well, they handed them.
They handed him the paper, so it isn't stolen in the legal sense.
That distinction could be made. It would probably correct to some degree the false impression that he just outright burglarized the place and stole them. However, as a practical legal matter, the case is so easily won on the simple issue of who owns the ideas. I mean, you could walk into court and say, "Judge, let's agree that Robin Scott broke into the building, assaulted the night watchman, hit him over the head with a flashlight, grabbed the papers, fled into the night, and gave them to David Mayo." Let's assume that. Now the issue is, we got all these copies of these documents in these various locations. We got all these people who were practicing stolen knots. Now, we should hang Robin Scott for committing this burglary from pillar to post, and I hope the government authorities over there did it. If you're on the side of the church, this guy's just a felon. But, so what? Can you now, because he stole these ideas, say that all these people out there who want to follow these ideas can't do it, even if he is the most abject criminal on the face of the earth? I mean, there are a lot of people who might think he's a hero, and I'm probably one of them. But if we agree that he stole them, he robbed them, and he plundered and pillaged, but it is obvious that under our jurisprudence in our society, you cannot enjoin David Mayo or anyone up there from practicing the processes and procedures in those ideas. You cannot go out and collect all the copies of those documents that they used to process those ideas. If you want the original pieces of paper back, here they are. Walk into the courtroom, put them in front of the judge, and say the issue is not these pieces of paper. The issue is in what is in my mind about not. And you cannot enjoin me from doing it, even if I admit to you that my accomplice over here, Robin, stole them. And that's the issue. And let's have a trial about who owns these ideas. And I think the Ninth Circuit, from what I heard went on, is going to arrive at that inevitable, inescapable, obvious conclusion that you can't copyright and sell and restrict other people from selling religious ideas in order to make a lot of $1 million.
Mm-hmm. Nobody has pledged not to read the Bible.
I mean, it'd be, you know, if I broke into a temple down here and let's suppose the Old Testament was in some secret place and I stole the book of Isaiah, and I went in, and they went into federal court and they said, well, look, this guy stole the sacred manuscript. And the judge says, yeah, give him back the sacred manuscript. Here's the sacred manuscript back. But cannot they prevent me from talking about what's in the book of Isaiah, and if it's a religious practice or belief, whatever? It's absurd.